Really, we ought to stop just right there. Just sit in silence for the next 45 minutes, please. Thank you, David, for that beautiful introduction. As for including me in this year's celebration of LGBT Week at Lancaster. When I was in high school, a recent convert to Catholicism, I would sometimes daydream that I would one day be a Franciscan theologian in one of the old colegios in central Mexico. Other days, I would daydream that I would become a Geronimite nun, like my great idol, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. But I had a typical queer youth. But never did I imagine that I would one day be speaking in such a magnificent Reformed pulpit in Pennsylvania. I am very glad to be here, although I still wish I were a Geronimite nun. With so much going on around it, after that jubilant concert last night, a lecture can seem a curiously quiet sort of event. Even a sermon has more going for it, better costumes, musical backup, and at least sometimes more imaginative choreography. Still, it may be that during this late morning hour, we can put to good use the very quietness of the lecture, can learn from its minimalism in a world of excessive media. I offer this lecture as a sort of interlude during which we can reflect, can receive, not only from the events of these days, but from the larger and longer struggles for the recognition of queer Christian lives. And please let me use that word queer as a catch-all term in place of the ever-lengthening string of initials LGBTQIQ squared. Indeed, I use the older form of the acronym in the title of the lecture just to remind us how often it changes. So I'll set aside the initials for the word queer, by which I mean all the erotic others, all those who can't quite identify as heterosexual, even if they play one in daily life. This is a good hour to receive, I said, to receive the witness that is carried to us in those church struggles. We should begin with the witness rather than with the tediously familiar arguments about Christianity and homosexuality. The beginning of our thinking about these issues shouldn't be church policies or Christian ethics or even the meaning of certain scriptural verses. The starting point is the witness of queer lives inside Christian churches. We wouldn't be disputing about policies, sexual ethics, or that handful of decontextualized verses unless there were people who were bearing witness both to their queerness and to their faith, to their minority sexuality and their continued call as Christians. If queer people did what some people think they should do, if they left the churches as soon as they came out, or even better, suffocated their desires as soon as they became conscious of them, we would not be having these disputes. Instead, honestly, queer people come out and then keep coming to church. That is the unexpected witness that the churches need to receive. The witness comes first from the past. Struggles over this witness have by now lasted a long time. I'm not thinking in terms of millennia, though we could find fragments of an ancient history in which believers with dissident erotic lives made spaces for themselves in the middle of persecuting Christian societies. Sometimes they made space right in the middle, inside church institutions, which have often given sanctuary to those who couldn't easily perform standard gender roles. But today I'm thinking of a more recent history and a more local one. The struggle to gain acceptance for people called homosexuals has been building in American churches since the 1950s. Already in that decade, we find queer-affirming groups splintering off from major denominations, or clergy within denominations planning special ministries of outreach. Beginning in the 1950s, there is also a series of books in English that urges reconsideration of church teaching. Let me name some of the books, because they too are a witness. Listen to the topics, and especially the dates. If you want the bibliography, or indeed if you want the whole text of the lecture, I'm happy to give you one later. But for the moment, just float in the words of these books. In 1956, Homosexuality and the Western Christian Tradition was published by a staff member of the Church of England's Moral Welfare Council, Derek Sherwin Bailey. Bailey is one of the first to argue at length that most of the biblical passages supposedly about homosexuality, including the most infamous, the story of Sodom, are in fact not pertinent to contemporary church discussions. This is 1956, remember. In 1960, a Congregationalist minister, Robert W. Wood, brought out Christ and the Homosexual, which was widely reviewed and eagerly discussed in homophile organizations, as they were then called. Wood's book is not nearly so coherent or so expert as Bailey's, but some of its pages do offer realistic portrayals of gay lives, both in urban bars and in suburban parsonages. Realistic portrayals of queer lives are not the norm in Christian writing, which has too often contented itself with ugly caricatures and threatening insults. In 1963, a group of British Quakers printed a pamphlet entitled Towards a Quaker View of Sex. The pamphlet suggests, astonishingly, that homosexual relations should be judged by the same criteria as heterosexual ones, and it gives equal consideration to male and female homosexuality. The 1970s brought applications of liberation theories and theologies to gender and sexuality. Rosemary Ruther's Religion and Sexism appeared in 1973. So did an initial public summary of John McNeill's manuscript, The Church and the Homosexual, which he read at the first National Meeting of Dignity, an organization for honestly queer Catholics. The mention of dignity reminds us that the struggles to bear witness during the last half century have also been struggles to find each other, to form groups, and that some Christian denominations have given indispensable help to those efforts. There are many examples from the 1950s on. One of the most interesting remains the Council on Religion and the Homosexual, founded jointly in 1964 by Protestant clergy and leaders of San Francisco's homophile organizations, including the head of the Tavern Guild, the Association of Local Bars. This council operated for a decade out of Glide Memorial Church, run by Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, holding conferences and producing educational materials. It also hosted the equivalent of a church dance for queer people on New Year's Day, 1965. Permits and permissions had been negotiated, but the San Francisco police still harassed those attending, not least by photographing everyone entering the premises and then repeatedly demanding access to the hall. When two lawyers with the council finally asked to see a search warrant, they were arrested, along with the straight woman collecting tickets from those courageous enough to attend. This would be just another incident of police harassment, except for what happened next. Seven straight clergymen called a press conference at Glide Memorial Church to protest the intimidation. As they fully intended, their group photograph, this line of clerical collars, appears above the fold on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle. 1965, 4 years before Stonewall, and what an amazing group of allies that was. In 1968, 8 months before Stonewall, that is, before the street fights in New York that are supposed to be the beginning of gay liberation, 8 months before Stonewall, Troy Perry held the first Eucharist for what would rapidly become a national network of metropolitan community churches. With Troy, you get not only the Pentecostal confidence in founding churches. If they don't want you here, go down the street and open another one. But also in proclaiming divine calls to ministry, that deep trust that God does not abandon us, not even when Christian churches do. Once called to task by witnesses like Troy and many others, not all Christian churches were content to repeat the old abandonment of queer people. Beginning in 1970, you can trace a string of official statements from mainline denominations denouncing sodomy statutes and affirming basic civil rights and liberties for homosexual persons. And there were the precedent-breaking ordinations and consecrations of women. Astonishing idea. Some of these women not evidently heterosexual, and of openly gay men, including Bill Johnson in 1972. I could go on with the stories. I love these stories. I could go on also with the less happy stories. Anita Bryant, the ex-gay movement, the campaigns against queer clergy and seminarians. Or I could multiply the names of those who have written courageously as witnesses to these topics. Carter Hayward, John Boswell, Gloria Anzaldúa, Bob Goss, Marcella Althaus-Reed, Irene Munro. What a cloud of witnesses. But the stories I have already told and the books I've already mentioned are enough to make the point. These struggles in American churches have been carried on in public for at least half a century. They have accomplished much. Openly queer people can now be ordained in some Christian churches. They can find themselves fairly portrayed in some theological libraries, and they have some tools with which to discover messages of hope in the scriptures and theological traditions. None of this was true in 1950. These gains have come, moreover, in the face of an opposition that always seemed bigger, more lavishly funded, and better connected, in the face of a horrifying plague that is hardly over, and in the face of our own deepest wounds, including fears that our opponents were right all along and that Christianity could offer people like us nothing except condemnation. Receiving this courageous witness from the past is important, but we also need to receive in it a question, a caution. Our present is not exactly what was wanted by our predecessors. We have become accustomed, for example, to living in sharply divided Christian camps, in parallel churches that don't share much, even when they are nominally contained within a single denomination. If the earlier queer witnesses and their allies wished for a reformed, a renewed Christianity, we now tolerate a more divided one. We allow ourselves to be content when we are admitted a little way into the existing structures of church power, when honestly queer people are ordained to ministry or elected to church office. But the earlier vision foresaw new structures for church, especially in regard to governance. Many of us are now fighting for legal and churchly recognition of same-sex marriages, but the earlier vision dreamed a set of new relationships that would replace what marriage had become, or at least supplement it with something more prophetic, more hopeful, more flexible, less damaging. We can congratulate on ourselves on all that has been accomplished, but then we must remind ourselves that the witness of the past may point in other directions for the future. Indeed, it may lead us back to the beginning, to start over again with a more radical sense of purpose. The struggle to gain a foothold in the churches was conceived only as a first step, only a prelude. Queer people sought to stay in churches not mainly because they had objections to unjust criminalization, not mainly because they wanted to insist on general principles of fairness, not mainly because they saw themselves as members of a secular minority claiming its rights. Queer people held to their places in Christian churches because they professed that God had called them to, because they believed that the divine was still alive in them, not despite their queerness, but in and through their queerness. They made claims of justice for the sake of a freedom to bear Christian witness. Can I just say that again? Because that seems to me the point we often lose in the day-to-day political fray. They made claims of justice for the sake of a freedom to bear Christian witness. The struggles to be recognized by churches weren't supposed to end with our squeezing into the back pew as awkward and abashed new arrivals. Our predecessors wanted to be heard in church because they felt themselves messengers of an excluded word, a word from God to the churches. That is the core conviction of their witness. Queer believers and their allies need to receive, to revive that original witness so that we can remember that we too have been given a witness to bear in the present. We too carry a word. Frankly, I see signs in different places that we may have forgotten this word or despaired of it. For example, those of us who write queer theology have increasingly admitted to each other the worry that we are writing in circles. Elizabeth Stewart has described some of the causes of this unhelpful repetition. The causes are many. One problem is that theological conversation in seminaries or graduate programs spins more quickly than church conversations at large. Sometimes conversations in seminaries spin so quickly they go right off into the clouds. It is all too easy then for graduate students or faculty to become impatient when looking at congregational or denominational disputes. I feel this myself. Someone quotes the story of Sodom to me, and I just think, oh, please, we settled that 50 years ago. This is not an option. But this frustrating disconnection between the pace of academic theology and the pace of congregational discourse is not the only reason that queer theologians feel themselves to be going in circles. As Elizabeth Stewart shows, we have gone round and round within certain shared assumptions about queer identity, or movement politics, or rhetorical strategy. The same arguments get rehashed year in and year out. The same books get written and rewritten. And they're good books, but we don't need 30 separate titles of them. The sense of theological circling is accompanied, in my experience, by a gloomy stagnation in many of the groups that struggled so energetically during years past. The Catholic group Dignity, for example, began a membership decline in the late 1980s that it has never succeeded in reversing. At last summer's national meeting of Dignity, many of the heads in the room were white and not from a loose hand with the peroxide bottle. Membership numbers for MCC are also down from their peaks. Religious sociologists or historians of American churches could situate many of these changes within larger trends. Moreover, more importantly, numbers alone can never be equated with spiritual vitality. Some of the most energetic, history-changing movements in Christian history were much smaller than MCC is now. But I do think that queer Christians and their allies are called to reflection here, to wondering whether we still believe that we have a witness to bear. We are called to a kind of spiritual discernment, to an examination of conscience, if you'll let me use the old word. Some of the present theological circling, some of the institutional stagnation, is the result of our fears and our vices. We have not been bold enough in imagining what might be ours to witness, what excluded words might be ours to carry. Let me name just one vice, or rather, let me confess it, because I suffer it too. I succumb to it as much as anyone. The vice is the craving for acceptance from people who threw you out. Who can fail to understand this craving in queer people? On the scale of generations, just yesterday, being honestly queer often meant bitter exile, fleeing or being thrown out from your birth family, giving up aspirations for professional prestige or even steady employment, living in fear of any number of government agencies. So of course, queer people crave acceptance, want to succeed in the world's eyes, want to be respectable, want to have the most normal looking lives. Our churches must have all the trappings and all of the titles of the world's big churches. But craving for acceptance, however understandable, interferes with bearing witness to an excluded word. Craving acceptance, queer Christians have forgotten some of the word they were sent to bring as witness. What is that word? Why is it a word entrusted to queer people, though not only to them? It was not entrusted to queer people because we are better, purer, or holier than other people, though we are, of course, absolutely the most fabulous creatures on the face of the earth. And it was not entrusted to us because we understand this word so much better than anyone else. It's not as simple as we're here, we're queer, get used to it, or even please recognize us as full church members just like everyone else. Bearing this kind of witness can never be reduced to a slogan. On the contrary, we bear witness to what is enigmatic in our experience, not to what is clear. Often we carry the word of what we suffer or desire rather than what we understand. Still, I might say that the word entrusted to queer people is a critique of certain lies that worldly power tells about itself through gender and sexuality. This critical word has been entrusted to queer people, among others, because they carry the deep contradictions of the power structures of gender and sexuality. Unable to obey those power structures because of their created desire, they suffer punishment. And so see how violence is used to enforce claims about divine creation or divine command. Same-sex desire is not just any interruption of our prevailing power structures. It is an interruption down at the base of those structures, because they depend on a number of illusions about sexuality and gender, including the natural subordination of one sex to another in the reproductive family. Same-sex desire exposes those illusions. It shows that much of what worldly power calls nature or divine creation can be experienced otherwise, has been created by God otherwise. And so same-sex desire shakes all the supposedly divine social hierarchies that rest on simplistic valuations of gender duality. Only by acknowledging the necessary connection of gender and sexuality to other kinds of power can I begin to understand the horror that gender transgressions provoke, the violence with which they are punished. Why does it feel so urgent to attack, to torture, to kill someone like Matthew Shepard or Brandon Tina or Sakya Gunn? Why is bashing gay men to toughen them up or raping lesbians to convert them such understandable violence in our society? Because it is violence that polices, that enforces the most familiar social distribution of power. It's no wonder then that queer Christians have difficulty in bearing witness to this word that was given to them to speak against power. No wonder that we want to lay it down, to stop carrying it, to exchange it for a nice quiet place in the back pew, where we can time the homily and fan ourselves with the program. Only we can't. Queer believers have been given a witness for today. I'm not predicting in saying that we and our allies will win all the political fights overnight, even with divine assistance. Churches are often adept at resisting divine impulses. I'm also not predicting that we should win all those political fights. Should queer people be full members of churches? Yes, of course, of course. Should women be ordained? Yes, of course. But that is not the only thing we should be. That is not the extent of the calling. The measure of the witness is not its success in gaining a share of worldly power. On the contrary, the measure of the witness is its capacity to speak the gospel against power, including the settled power of churches. We do not bear witness to fixed identities in order to be admitted through them to power. We bear witness to what we are becoming beyond identities, in the imagination of something other than the routines of churchly power. Perhaps you're thinking that I've spun off into the clouds myself by this point. My friend Mary Talbert says, "Mark, you don't write lectures, you write long Zen poems." So let me propose three specific challenges for queer Christians as they try to bear witness without repeating the routines of power. Let me name three particular tasks that confront queer Christians in scriptural interpretation, in worship, and in ethics or moral theology. First challenge, scriptural interpretation. And here I'm not thinking of the so-called clobber passages, that is, the handful of verses that are ripped out of scriptural context to condemn queer desire or queer acts. On the contrary, the challenge is to model a scriptural interpretation that does not deal in clobber passages, that does not treat the scriptures as a Guinness Book of World Records to be used in settling barroom disputes. In our churchly disputes over homosexuality, we have fallen back into some of the worst habits of reading the Bible, as if it were an indexed compendium of facts and regulations that only needed to be cited properly in order to win cases. In disputes over homosexuality, you will often hear from one side that the issue is biblical authority. The Episcopal Bishop of Pittsburgh was quoted as saying this just last week. I agree with him. I'm not sure he'd be happy to hear that. I agree with him, but probably not in the way he intends. The ongoing disputes do present issues of biblical authority, namely of the kind of authority that the Bible has, and of who has authority over its meaning. I believe that the scriptures have unique authority among Christian texts, but I also believe that they do not lend their authority to readers who would treat them only as ammunition. The challenge for queer Christians, the witness they are asked to bear, would remind churches that the Bible is a book of enigmas. The New Testament in particular is built around this central enigma. Jesus wrote nothing. There is a deliberate gap between Jesus and any text about him. One important sign of that gap in the biblical text is that we have four different gospels, not one. There is no single authoritative text about Jesus because none is possible. The four gospels further remind us that misunderstanding fills the gap between Jesus and texts. He is regularly misunderstood in the gospels by those who suppose that they should understand him, namely by his students. He is understood instead by outsiders, and Jesus speaks to these outsiders as often by action, by transgressive touch, as by word. This line of thinking would suggest that queer believers and their allies might need to approach scriptural controversy with new expectations. We have often replied to the use of scripture against us by doing better philology or more detailed history. I've done this myself, for example, with regard to the story of Sodom. But this kind of reply doesn't get at the heart of the dispute. Historico-philological exegesis doesn't persuade someone who is holding onto a copy of the Scofield Bible as the only certainty in a sea of troubles. Talking about violations of the nomadic host-guest bond at Sodom doesn't convince someone who can read right in their own copy of the New RSV that St. Paul condemns sodomites alongside other sexual sinners. Before we can contest those mistranslations or the sovereign authority of Scofield's notes, we have to address the expectations, the needs that different readers bring to these texts. We cannot do that under the heat of controversy. We do it only when we model an alternate relation to the scriptures, not just to the clobber verses, but to the whole of the scriptures. We have to bear witness in our daily practice that the scriptures don't have to be a fearsome law code in order to shape Christian lives. They can still have authority over us as a text that is built around a central silence, that addresses excluded hearers, that is full of transgressive actions. The second challenge, worship and sacrament. And here I'm not thinking of the challenge to include honestly queer Christians in worship, either by extending rites and sacraments to them or by permitting them to have leadership roles. I think that those things should happen, of course, but they are not the most important part of the witness. The challenge is not inclusion, but recognition. The challenge is not to let queer believers into church services, but to let them bring in a word about all the divine services happening outside. One of the most remarkable things in the last half century is the tenacity with which queer believers have clung to Christian worship. When they are denied the Eucharist, they seek out ministers to celebrate it elsewhere. Exactly this happened at a Catholic parish in Atlanta in 1946. When queer Christians are denied blessings on their unions, they engage to be married in secret. When churches refuse to mourn or bury their dead, queer believers perform their own memorials. There is more. Queer believers and their friends compose rituals to celebrate the stages where queer life differs from straight life, in the repeatable and mysterious sacrament of coming out, for example, or in the annual celebration of Pride, which is as close to a religious pilgrimage as I think most Americans get. By persisting in worship, by improvising and inventing rituals when they were denied them, queer believers witness to the importance of liturgy, to the ways it gives and sustains lives. The lives of queer Christians still often lived in exile from churches can teach churches to recognize worship in unexpected forms and places, in despised bodies and ridiculed communities. Real liturgy can be performed by unauthorized ministers in prohibited places, borrowing texts, gestures, and sacred vessels as they can. Receiving this witness, churches learn something about all Christian worship. No matter how well rehearsed, all Christian worship is an unlikely improvisation in the face of the divine. I have been known to claim that all Christian liturgy is camp, is an expression of that famously queer sensibility that finds beauty where it shouldn't be. For me, camp is the deeply incarnational sensibility of Christianity. After all, Christianity is finding divinity where it isn't supposed to be. Camp sensibility, like a theology of incarnation, is animated by an impossible confidence. It trusts that divine realities can withstand humor, can shine through improbable material, can catch us when we risk ourselves beyond the limits of decent expression. Camping is an act of faith, which is to say, an act of love, a love that invites the beloved to respond even to fractured forms, to unlikely improvisations, because those are the best we can manage before God. Which brings me to the third challenge, the last, Christian ethics or moral theology. The real challenge here is not to justify queer sexual practices or queer loves according to the prevailing books of rules. After all, according to those traditional books of rules, most of what most married couples do is also unnatural and sinful. The excluded word that queer believers bring is the reminder that Christian morality is not about rules, but about vicariously transformed lives. It is about becoming oneself by putting on another. The fundamental category in churchly ethics isn't an act, a law, a sentiment, or even a virtue, but the new figures, the new characters that the preaching of the gospel and the practice of Christian worship promise to elicit as a gift. Christians tend to forget that there is no detailed ethical code in the New Testament, which is why Christian codifiers so often and so clumsily excerpt the Hebrew scriptures. What we get in the Gospels is not a moral code, but a series of moral exhortations and stories framed within the telling of a life, of a biography. Christian ethics ought to be most concerned with the forms of life, because it arises in response to the way that Jesus' life makes room for our new lives. The same concern can be clear in Christian worship. Worship teaches forms for our lives by recalling Jesus' exhortations and narratives, but also by re-identifying us with him through ritual and giving us occasion to practice our new selves in church. Worship is a theater of lived possibilities and a space for inhabiting them. Queer Christians bring the word that human erotic capacity has a place in that liturgical theater, that desiring human bodies can also be redeemed. Bringing that word, they reverse old churchly charges against them. The medieval theology of the sodomite says, "You are completely consumed by the desire of your damned flesh." Queer believers can now reply, "It's your desires that we carry, as well as our own." Sodomites and lascivious witches were some of the scapegoats for Christianity's inability to imagine sexual desire within the kingdom of heaven. Scapegoats for sex, but therefore also its protectors and guardians. The challenge for queer Christians and their allies in the present moment is to deliver back the erotic to churches as a teaching and a question for everyone. During centuries, queer people were told in church, "You are nothing but sinful sex." Now they are challenged not only to show churches that sexual desire is good, is divinely created, but that they are more than an essentialized desire. The challenge is to show how sexual desire can flourish within the whole of a Christian life without being suffocated, lied about, or distorted. We have been made the extreme case of erotic sin. We can now cooperate in redeeming the erotic within Christian life, the gift brought back to the churches by scapegoats. Sometimes after a lecture like this, a member of the audience will complain in bewilderment or in anger, "All you homosexuals talk about is sex." I'm sometimes tempted to reply, "That's the role you gave us, to make up for so much inability to talk about sex." But what I really mean to say, less flippantly, is this. The witness we have been given to bear in the enigma of our desiring bodies is indeed about sex, but not only about sex. Beginning from desire, it reaches out through scripture, through worship, through ethics, to the whole of Christian life as desire for God. The struggle was never for our acceptance alone, never for ourselves alone, and we must not be content to let the struggle become just that in the present. We bear a witness to be received by all in the shape of lives, not in the battle of words. Do we still have a witness to bear? Yes, we do, in this very hour, for the sake of all, in churches and outside of them. Thank you.